This is The Irrationally Exuberant. I'm Reed Messerschmidt.
Eddie Vedder was born in 1964. A scowling, silent baby with a thick head of hair and a cruel wizard's humorless grin. But that was just an act. Even then, fresh from the womb, dripping with his mother's inner juices, there were two Eddie Vedders. The intense one with the weird smile and the handsome charmer, brimming with good-natured mumbles and empathy. The second one was the real Eddie Vedder, but he sometimes got confused and thought the first was. That one seemed more interesting. When, at 6 months, baby Eddie Vedder finally cried aloud, he'd cried internally almost constantly, of course. It was guttural, soulful, and deep. His family was shocked to hear the voice of a grief-stricken muscleman coming from a wee infant, but relieved to hear any noise at all. His mother didn't breastfeed. Folks were dumber in the 60s than they are today and didn't realize the importance of such things. Eddie Vedder intuitively understood this, that the denial of direct sustenance, the ultimate maternal bonding experience, was not malicious, but it still stung a little. His eye for betrayal was prematurely keen, and this was the second of many. The first was, of course, being brought into a flawed world from such comfortable nothingness, and later the cozy confines of the womb with its pleasant warmth and ambient sounds. The third betrayal was one he'd write about later, his father. See 80% of the lyrics on 10 for reference. This is how Eddie Vedder came to be in reality, but in my soul, the soul of a semi-depressive teenager, my baby fat just beginning to melt away, lost in self-consciousness, anxiety, and the management of my ever-hardening wiener, Eddie Vedder, the idea of Eddie Vedder in all caps, was born in Fargo, North Dakota in 1995 on Woodcrest Drive in a wood-paneled basement bedroom. The Vedder sperm launched from the speaker phallus of my Iowa stereo with 8-CD changer, its other 7 trays filled mostly with other, lesser, alternative bands, Candlebox and Dishwalla and Better Than Ezra, and the refreshments at Eels and Bush and the Goo Goo Dolls, if memory serves. It sometimes doesn't. And one of the spermatozoa, the chosen one, permeated the cell wall of my heart egg. The spermatozoa's name was, "Hey Foxy Mop Handle Mama, that's me." Just kidding. That's a little insider Pearl Jam humor. The oral spermatozoa's name was actually Last Exit. It was dark and weird and charmingly imperfect, and its genetic strands interlaced with the genetic strands of my heart. An angsty zygote was formed. The zygote grew and grew until it filled me up. I was large with Vedder, a weird parody of the Virgin Mary, the Virgin Messerschmitt, my brain cervix ever widening, wandering through the wilderness, searching for a place to give birth, but alas, all of my friends were listening to Green Day or Tupac, and my parents were preoccupied with ruining each other's lives, and I was forced to make my camp alone. My calling? To understand Eddie Vedder. Okay, this confused metaphor has stretched as far as it's going to go. What I'm getting at is this. I really loved Pearl Jam when I was 13. Specifically, I loved Eddie Vedder. And for the next 4 years, that love shaped me in ways that I'm still unraveling. I'm grateful for that, though I don't love them or him in the way that I used to and haven't connected to anything they've made since Yield in 1998. My love for Eddie Vedder has become that of a grown son to a surrogate father. Complicated and maybe a little embarrassed, but love nonetheless. And gratitude and respect. Or the love for an ex-girlfriend that made you a better person. The same as the surrogate father thing, but more sexually complicated, hopefully. So this is a love letter of sorts, and a thank you and maybe an exploration of what fandom can mean. Let's start with a history. The history of Eddie Vedder and me. This is going to be a bit self-indulgent, so bear with me. Or don't, you can always just turn it off. The year is 1990. MC Hammer and the Cramps release albums on the same day. Please Hammer, Don't Hurt 'Em, and Stay Sick, respectively. I go all in on Hammer and remain unaware of the cramps for several more years because I am 7. Also, the Hammer album has, inarguably, a cooler name. Quite possibly the greatest album title ever, now that I really think about it, with maybe the exception of The Earth, A Small Man, His Dog, and a Chicken by REO Speedwagon. Also that year, Sammy Davis Jr. and Jim Henson die on the same day, which seems meaningful but probably isn't. Boris Yeltsin is elected president of Russia and Home Alone hits theaters. At the time, I am unaware of all of these things but one. I'll let you decide which. The answer will not surprise you. But of course, the most important event of 1990 is this. Eddie Vedder joins what will soon become Pearl Jam. I've mentioned this on the show before, but I'll say it quickly again as it has bearing on what followed. I wasn't allowed to watch MTV when I was young, but I was allowed to watch VH1, which I did obsessively, and at the time meant consuming massive amounts of what was known as light rock, or soft rock, or adult contemporary. All meaningless, as the terms apparently covered everything from, say, John Mellencamp to Gloria Estefan to Sade and even pump-era Aerosmith. I fucking loved it. I was Bryan Adams' youngest fan, something I know for certain because I saw him live when I was 10, got backstage even, and I didn't see any other kids there. Some old asshole spilled white wine all over my concert tee. It was all very grown up, and grown up is how I wanted to feel. And like I said, Hammer slipped in there somewhere as well, an anomaly. This phase lasted for what seemed like a very long time. And then one day in 1992 at Longfellow Elementary in the gymnasium during what was known as gym class, I heard Nirvana for the first time. Smells Like Teen Spirit. The gym teacher, Mr. Disher, a broad-shouldered, deeply tanned, mustachioed man in a perpetual tracksuit, began each class with a few minutes of jogging in circles around the gym. He would let us choose which song to jog to. Each day, a different kid would bring in a CD. I very clearly remember loudly singing along to When She Cries by Restless Heart in between gasps for air, my chubby little stomach jiggling, my bowl cut flopping majestically, and my heart aching for the titular she. There was this kid in my class, Paul Thurston, tall and lanky, his bowl cut sharply parted down the middle. He was constantly pushing the hair out of his eyes. He was pale, we all were, and a little weird, we all were. But his weird was particularly off-putting somehow, accompanied by a perma-sneer and a sarcastic laugh, like he thought he was better than the rest of us. I think he'd moved to Fargo from somewhere a bit more connected to the zeitgeist. I liked him, though. We were in-class friendly, but not close. It was his day to bring in music, and he brought Nevermind. Asked Mr. Disher to play Smells Like Teen Spirit, of course. Now, I don't recall being thunderstruck by Nirvana, but I was curious. I jogged up next to Paul and asked him what it was. He excitedly told me, and I very clearly remember telling him that the lead singer sounded like Bryan Adams with a sore throat. Not a false statement, I have to say. So I began exploring grunge and eventually ended up deciding that my very favorite band was Live. Not grunge at all, really. Kind of a bad Pearl Jam knockoff slash omen of Creed's to come. Before I go any further, the timeline of everything here is a mess. I tried to confirm dates, but when you use albums as life markers, that becomes tricky. In some cases, I got an album the day it came out. In other cases, I got it 3 years after the fact. And a few months of a teenager's life feels so definitive that it almost always seems longer than it was. Events that may only have happened once feel like they happened all the time. It's one of the weirdest parts of being a parent to watch these really minor things imprint on a kid and then recontextualizing the things that imprinted on you. What I'm saying is, don't worry about the timeline. I was there and can't untangle it. Okay, so there was Live, who's not really grunge, but also there was Soundgarden and Alice in Chains and all of the bands that were in my CD changer and so forth. And Metallica. There was a brief moment in the mid-90s where literally everyone on the planet was a Metallica fan, regardless of age or genre affiliation. and Paul led the way for me musically. He played guitar, kind of, and we'd sit in his room, he on the bed and me on the floor, and over he'd say, okay, tell me what this one is, and then clumsily play some riff and look at me expectantly. I'd say something like, Guns N' Roses? And he'd say something like, what? No, it's the Melvins. And then we'd do that again and again and again while I wondered if the Thurstons had any good snacks. Another brief side note, because this is too good not to share. Paul attempted to start a band when we were in sixth grade, even though he was the only person that actually played an instrument. The drummer didn't have a drum, just a music stand and a pie tin, for instance. I was to be their manager, which irked me a bit. Why couldn't I actually be in the imaginary band? But now that makes a lot of sense, actually. Anyway, the great part is this. Paul already had a name for the band, Ataxia. Not bad. And he had decided that the first album would be called Guitars, Guitars, Etc. A name so terrible, I've been in love with it for the past 20 years. Again, anyway. Paul especially loved Pearl Jam, and I liked Pearl Jam. Daughter was all over the radio, Alive and Jeremy and Evenflow had never left, but I didn't like them as much as I liked Live, the band who wrote the greatest song ever, to this day, to mention a placenta in the first 8 words, the ever-majestic Lightning Crashes. Live, in retrospect, was a very weird choice for a kid my age, but one that many people at the time were presumably making. You have to understand that this was well before we had the internet to tell us what we enjoyed and despised. So the cultural landscape was littered with the mass delusions of an ignorant, undirected public relying solely on their true and natural feelings. Why, a man would have to drag himself through the bald fluorescent lights of a media play and pony up 13 bones if you wanted to hear the latest tunes coming from Seattle or LA or New York or I don't know where Live is from. Idaho? Somewhere landlocked, I'm sure of it. And if he wanted to find out about new music, he might have to flip through an honest-to-God paper magazine. So I started buying magazines. Hit Parader and Circus, both of which were still awkwardly pivoting from metal to alt-rock, meaning that pictures of, say, the feminine, handsome, forlorn mug of Scott Weiland still bumped up against pictures of Don Dokken with no shirt and leather pants or Blackie Lawless being generally gross. I bought Rolling Stone and Spin as well, which felt very adult. All I cared about was the grunge, which itself pretty quickly pivoted to the even more meaningless alternative. It didn't mean anything grunge, but then again it did. It was alternately angry and sad white guys and the occasional lady in a dirty sundress howling into the void. A time-tested recipe for success. I always far preferred the ones that drifted way over to the sad side, of course. Those were unquestionably the good ones. Too angry and you'd veer into hardcore or metal, or in some horrifying occasions, bands would go the opposite way and toss in a little white guy funk. That's how mad they were. It drove them crazy. Grunge was such a big deal, spoke to so many people because it was the first truly utile genre of music. Anyone could wear some jeans and a t-shirt and a dirty old flannel. You didn't even have to look that weird to your parents. It was kind of a statement, but an amorphous enough one that anyone could adapt it to themselves and work it into their life without overturning it too much. Everyone was and is a little sad and angry. In the past, rock stars were gods. You wouldn't be able to do what they were doing in a million years, no matter how hard you tried. You could play like the punk guys. They weren't very good for the most part, but they were still gods. You could never be as weird as they were and live any semblance of a normal life, but they were getting laid off of it. The grunge guys were very much just dudes. The whole package was attainable, seemingly. But the problem with grunge was the same thing that made it great. Its adaptability. Pretty soon, as always happens, the boneheads took over. The capital D dudes bullied their way in. And they'd learned all the wrong lessons. All they got was the anger and masculinity. There wasn't any of the sadness. It was sad. For me, though, that couldn't have mattered less. In the beginning, all grunge was created equal. I devoured Alice in Chains and Tad and Big Dish and Better Than Ezra with equal relish. Were those last two grunge? They were to me. I saw it, I think, as a way to carve an identity from my Dutch elm and aphid rich family tree. I loved my parents, but the way they went about life looked untenable to me. It became clear to me pretty early on that I'd have to look elsewhere for my role models. But none of these grunge fellows were right exactly. And then there was Eddie Vedder, the man of my dreams, right there all along, lurking shyly in the shadows, revealed to me finally by the brilliant light of a dark album, Vitology. Now, if I'm not mistaken, the public image of Eddie Vedder is, and has been for a long time, that of an earthy, low-key American Bono, or a more likable, less toxic and wasted, non-misogynist version of whatever Johnny Depp and Sean Penn are. Monosyllabic, tobacco-soaked scarf bros with the skin of an unpleasantly leather-bound book. And I can't disagree exactly. But the Eddie Vedder that existed in 1995, when I first really got him, was a very different Eddie Vedder, prone to army jackets, moping, and rage. He was pale. He wouldn't look directly at a camera. And he had things to say that felt very important to a 13-year-old with a basement bedroom. Revelatory. He felt like a real artist. The kind of guy that would scrawl pro-choice on his arm with a Sharpie during a show, or convey his grief for Kurt's passing on Saturday Night Live with a nondescript K printed on a brown shirt in Sharpie. He made a lot of statements via Sharpie, and so did I, mostly by scrawling band names on my school binders. To give you an idea of how cool I was, I very distinctly remember carefully printing the words Alanis Morissette on a green binder with a blue one. I didn't so much see myself in Eddie Vedder, I saw the potential for myself, a viable direction to move toward. I don't think I much thought about the end result being the same as his. I had no concrete dreams of fronting a rock band, though I did eventually, kind of. We were called Dr. Zhivago, and our only real gig was at something called Potato Days, where we played a cover of Do the Evolution. But I thought a lot about becoming more the kind of person that he was, regardless of occupation. Some background on who Eddie Vedder was at the time, or who I thought he was anyway. Pearl Jam was fucking huge, and as per the fashion of the day, Eddie Vedder had decided he didn't want to be fucking huge. He wanted to be an artist. He wanted to be Dylan in 67, who had wanted to be Rambo in 1884, which is to say that they both wanted to be a thing that didn't exist. A pure artist, free to create and fully understood, unhassled. That this was impossible made them both very angsty. Dylan handled this by being mean to everyone, getting into a motorcycle accident, and making an album of weird love songs sung in the style of a drunk man impersonating Kermit the Frog, impersonating Roy Orbison, which actually turned out to be pretty good, oddly. Eddie Vedder stopped speaking in full sentences, started insisting on playing the guitar, and wrote an accordion song about insects, which did not actually turn out to be pretty good, but is kind of fun. He was shaggy and upset. He wrote a song called Not For You, clarifying who he was making music for. Himself and the true fans, not the frat boys and trend chasers. Me, I thought. He wrote another song called Corduroy, about the same thing, named for a reproduction of a brown corduroy jacket he wore sometimes, which I deeply coveted, and still do, that he saw for sale at an exorbitant price. He wrote a song called Satan's Bed about selling out, a popular topic of the day. I'll never suck Satan's dick, he shouted, never one for subtlety. He wrote a song called Immortality, which seemed like it was about Kurt Cobain's suicide, but also seemed like it might be about Eddie Vedder's impending suicide and was actually about neither of those things. All of this was very specific to Eddie Vedder, and I'm not entirely sure why it felt so relatable to me. It wasn't just the music. I loved the music, but I'm a lyrics guy, so it was very much about those. I guess they expressed some vague nihilism lurking inside of me, a teenage desire not to be fucked with, maybe a sheltered suburban white liberal kid's desire to be victimized somehow. More probably, what appealed to me was how personal it all was. Even when he was political, it was personal. I wanted to reveal my inner life as openly as he was, but at 13, 14-year-old boy doesn't open up like that outside of bad poetry slash song lyrics that he doesn't share with anyone, which I was writing a lot of. I still have most of it in an old duffel bag. Here is a horrifying example. All right. The tears won't come. I haven't cried in weeks. I wish I could. It would come as a relief. I know I'm still alive. I need to know there's something left inside of me. Pent up like a dog, but my only restraint is fear. Someone's got to hear my cries. Someone's got to tell me those soft, soothing, comforting lies. Locked up and lonely, searching for my only purpose in life, trying to find my analogy. Maybe I'm a stray dog looking for a friend. Maybe I'm a psychotic child's warped idea of playing pretend. Maybe I'm a prisoner locked up in his cell. Maybe I'm the world on a highway to hell. Maybe I'm a lock without a key. Or maybe I'm just me. Maybe my problems are central to me. Maybe the universe revolves around me. Maybe, maybe, maybe. I cried last night for the first time in weeks. I was so happy. It was such a relief to know that I am still alive, to know there's something left inside of me. Oof. Whatever it was about Eddie Vedder, it got me. And in an early incarnation of a thing I now do all the time, I dove in headfirst. I bought every magazine that mentioned Pearl Jam and cut out all of the pictures of them. I taped them to my walls along with the posters that I bought. I bought the maxi singles, all of them eventually. I joined the 10 Club, of course. I bought import CDs, which were basically just live compilations of unknown origin. Those pulled me even further in. One of the greatest things about Pearl Jam and Eddie in particular is how generous they are with their influences. And these CDs with photocopied pictures of the band on the cover were filled with revealing and revelatory covers. Neil Young, Dead Boys, Split Enz, Van Halen, The Ramones, Otis Redding, The Byrds, The Beatles, The Who, Daniel Johnston, Little Steven, weirdly, Arthur Alexander, Tom Petty, Lucinda Williams, and Bob Dylan. It expanded my horizons, as they say. I bought albums from the band members' previous bands, Green River and Mother Love Bone, desperately tried to get my hands on a Bad Radio recording, and even all of their side projects. I bought Brad albums, for God's sakes. Brad albums. Hovercraft albums, even, and that was just Eddie's wife's thing. Alone in my room, I burned incense and used a putter as a microphone to bellow along with Eddie, somehow convinced that the rest of the house couldn't hear me over the music. I listened and listened, read the incomplete lyrics inside of Vitalogy's incredible packaging, a recreation of a 1903 medical book of the same name, with grotesque illustrations and half articles about phrenology and the dangers of masturbation. Fucking captivated, that's what I was. These were unexplored universes, and they spoke to me. Bizarre antiquities, individualism, rebellion, history, the 70s, anger, poetry, books, liberal politics, social justice, weird noise, intentionally difficult and confrontational art, abstract humor. It was all opening up to me, and to a large degree, has defined me as a person. And different facets continued to reveal themselves as Eddie Vedder continued to grow, continued to show me how to grow. I was listening to the radio as I fell asleep one night and the new Pearl Jam single came on, Who You Are. The tribal drums, the loose, jangly guitars, the weird self-love lyrics. Stoplight plays its part, so I would say you've got a part. It was a mess and a little dumb, and I loved it. I still love it. Eddie had turned another corner. He'd come out on the other side of all the rage and was reaching toward enlightenment. Yes, me too. I had just bought the Bob Marley box set. And holy shit was the album that followed great. No Code was maybe even greater than Vitalogy. It isn't really, but sometimes it seems like it might be. Look, I'm not going to go through all of this album by album, but I loved No Code, and then Eddie was doing stuff with Mike Watt and Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, and that shot me in other, even more exotic directions, and then there was Yield, fucking Given to Fly, another song I heard for the first time on the radio at bedtime, And Eddie was talking a lot about this book called Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, saying it was the inspiration for the album. And that book opened up whole new worlds, and they toured with Ben Harper, and I somehow fell for that garbage. And then finally, I got to see Pearl Jam live, and that was revelatory. Frank Black opened. The Pixies. I had never heard the Pixies. And the concert experience was so communal and so beautiful. I brought along this big tape recorder and was going to tape the show. And this guy smoking a joint next to my friend Travis and I said, "Cool, man, I'll try to keep it down for you." But I couldn't keep it down, and the tape is mostly just me yelling and singing along. At that point, I had something like 60 Pearl Jam CDs, an astounding amount for a band that had 5 official albums. And Pearl Jam was all I wanted to talk about. We got a dog, and I named it Eddie. And then Binaural came out, and I couldn't have hated it more. I still hate it. It's so lifeless compared to what came before it. This was my senior year of high school, so there were other distractions too, obviously, and other musical directions to explore. Indie music, mostly. Belle and Sebastian can change a man, you know? And I'd started smoking pot, and Pearl Jam's not really a pot band. So my Pearl Jam love came to a screeching halt. Did I still wail along to Yellow Ledbetter on occasion? Of course. Everybody does that, I think. But I was more sophisticated now, and distancing my new self from my teenage self. I decided that Pearl Jam was terrible, a humorous phase I'd gone through. Riot Act came out and confirmed my feelings. It's a bad album. But when they toured on Riot Act, they announced a show in Fargo, at the Fargo Dome, a place where I had previously seen Fleetwood Mac, Metallica, the Harlem Globetrotters, Bush, the Goo Goo Dolls, No Doubt, the aforementioned Bryan Adams, WWF Wrestling, a Monster Truck Rally, the Shrine Circus, Semi-Pro Basketball, and Weezer. I couldn't not go. And so I began to make plans. I was 20 years old, perpetually heartbroken, and almost perpetually drunk. I'd convinced myself somehow that I had testicular cancer and had made the brave decision not to have it treated. I'd just waste away. If it got bad enough, I'd kill myself. This seemed reasonable. I was living in my mother's basement between rented houses. I discovered drinking alone. I was vomiting a lot for some reason. I assumed it was the cancer. I'd gotten really into Bright Eyes and Bukowski. I bought my ticket. I was going solo. It seemed only appropriate to experience Pearl Jam in the same way I always had, by myself. It's another of the lessons Eddie Vedder taught me, that loving something in isolation can be the most intense love. I also bought mushrooms, a small bag, dried and brittle. Before the show, I sat by myself on a mattress on the floor and ate them, washed them down with cheap jug wine. I'd taken them a few times before and mostly hated it. The first time was New Year's Eve before a party in a trailer home, which was a mistake. You've got to have space with mushrooms. Outside is a must. There had been a very tall girl in a very small room and some black lights and panic and finding my friend Brady sitting atop a refrigerator. We rang in the New Year lying on the floor of a friend's parents' bedroom waiting for the damned things to wear off, which they wouldn't for another 4 hours. When my friend noticed that it was 12:05, he muttered, "Happy fucking New Year." Another time, I had recently heard that Russell Crowe kept a man on staff whose only job was to light his cigarettes. This led me to imagine a team of wee men surrounding Russell Crowe, each with a very specific job, tying his left shoe, for instance. I talked about this for several hours before realizing that all of my friends had grown tired of it and left. So I didn't like mushrooms, but that had never stopped me from imbibing before. And then I laid down and waited for them to take effect. Fell asleep. When I woke an hour later, I still felt sober. It tends to take a couple hours before the weird self-inversion of a mushroom high starts to take effect, but it was nearing showtime, so I set out. My mother's house was only blocks from the dome. It was still light out, edging toward dusk, and 19th Avenue was unusually busy because of the show. I passed the high school I'd attended, reminisced a bit, congratulated myself for how sophisticated and miserable I'd become. I arrived at the dome about 20 minutes later, still straight, weaved through the bros and Cubs hats and hippie girls and aging rocker dudes, and as I pushed through the doors, it was like the scene in The Wizard of Oz where Dorothy opens the door to Oz, except instead of exploding with color, the world exploded with the anxiety unique to mushrooms. A bacchanal of panic and disassociation. My heart rate increased. I began to sweat. And the thing that always happens when I was too high or drunk or whatever kicked in. Pure survival instinct. No fun, no real comprehension, just the suppression of panic and the steely human will to maintain and pass for normal. Vision narrows, time stops. I was surrounded by people enjoying themselves, and they looked grotesque. The enemy. I somehow found my seat and resolved to face forward and wait it out. I remember very little of the first part of the concert. I stood because everyone was standing, but I did not clap, did not cheer, did not sing. I was amid a crowd, but curled up inside of myself. Pearl Jam were 1,000 miles away. And then there was Ocean. It pulled me out of myself, but not into the world, only into the music. My body began to move toward it, somnambulatory. I sang, floated and sang, and then somehow I was in the front row still singing and my dilated eyes locked into his, Eddie Vedder, the first actual human being I'd fully registered in over an hour. He was staring directly at me and we sang together. Then the song was over and he jumped down from the stage, beckoned me over the metal partition. I followed him up to the side of the stage, jogged there behind him. This was the dream. The culmination of all of those hours singing into the putter in my room. We climbed the stairs, and now I was on stage, dazed, being beckoned on by my childhood hero. The crowd was roaring, and I suddenly felt elated, actually high, instead of just loaded. I woke up, walked past Stone Gossard, who was kind of giving me the side eye. Stone fucking Gossard. I backtracked and gave him a hug. The whole stadium laughed. Mike McCready was tuning his guitar and Jeff was on the other side of the stage and there was a drum kit in front of Matt Cameron, so I let them be. Eddie was waiting. I ran to him, gave him a hug, engulfed him in myself. He was so small but more vivid than anyone I'd ever met. He smelled like cigarettes. And then he faced me toward the crowd. I was blinded, but they were very loud. Eddie leaned into me, his face against my ear, sweaty and hot, his beard scratchy on my cheek. "You all right?" "Yes," I said. "Do you know Nothing Man?" "Of course," I said. He turned to the band and they started to play Nothing Man. And I sang it with Pearl Jam, with Eddie Vedder, as Eddie Vedder. And I don't know where it came from, but I sang it beautifully. Eddie was grinning, alternately staring at me wonderingly and turning to the audience as if to say, "Can you believe this?" They could, but barely. They were going wild. I was out of my mind. I remember it, but only as a sense, a feeling, elation and power, some direct connection to my purpose and soul, and a moment of pure self-actualization. And then it was over and the crowd exploded and Eddie hugged me again and lifted my arm in victory and then another hug and then he pushed me toward backstage. I stumbled that way, and this time Mike wasn't too busy. He stared at me and smiled, mouth. That was incredible. And I went past him and out stage left, into the arc of backstage, past some people I barely noticed, barely heard congratulating me. I had one thought. Back to real life. It's all downhill from here. Imagined myself old and bloated, drunkenly telling a bored nephew about this while everyone rolled their eyes. The panic was back. The disassociation was back. I blindly searched for a bathroom, but found a closet instead. Good enough. I got in. I sat on the floor, closed the door after me, closed my eyes in the dark, and crawled back into myself. Time passed. When I opened my eyes, someone was outside the closet. Evidently, a long time had passed, and the concert was over because the roar was gone. My ears rang, and I felt very outside of myself. The door opened very quickly. Light shone in. I shielded my eyes. Then it closed again, and someone sat down across from me. I smelled cigarettes and sweat. And he didn't talk. I didn't talk. We sat there in silence. I felt at peace, resigned to myself, bathing in Eddie Vedder's aura. After a while, he stood up, grabbed my right hand in both of his, held it for a full minute. And then he left, and I fell asleep. I woke up in the closet with no idea of the time. It was dark and dead quiet, and my whole body hurt from sleeping upright. My mouth tasted like black olives from a tin can. I kicked open the closet doors. I See the World's on a Rocking Horse of Time is legitimately one of the worst lyrics ever, but I did see that. It is on a rocking horse of time. I exited the Fargo Dome in a haze, euphoric, feeling maybe I'd see a little better set of days. Elated, thoughts were arriving like butterflies. Everything made sense. And then, nearly 15 years later, I made this brilliant podcast, and I just can't believe that it's a coincidence. Thank you, Eddie Vedder. Whatever mystical gift you bestowed upon me that day is paying off in spades. And the real gifts, the music and the excavation of identity and the sense of direction, no matter how vague and imagined, that's all great too. Incalculably great. So, thank you, for real. The end.
Wired after you opened up worlds for me, and I'm appreciative.